This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning into Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we welcome Lily Siebert, Cultivate Kansas City's Outreach Coordinator, Neil Rudisil and Lisa Hummel, who are the operators of Woodland City KC, and also Nicole Routh, a member of the Scion Garden. We'll be having a conversation about this coming weekend's Urban Grown Tour. But first, I'm naturally with your headline news. Kansas City has had its first two ozone alerts. Air quality reached orange level concerns on Wednesday and Thursday. This is especially impactful on those with respiratory issues, as well as infants and the elderly. During ozone alerts, people are urged to avoid air quality harming activities such as mowing lawns or gassing up vehicles between 6 a.m. and 7 p.m. Vehicle operation should be kept to a minimum, and KCATA bus fares are reduced to 75 cents. TheGuardian.com reports, human-caused climate change appears to have driven the Great Barrier Reef's only endemic mammal species into the history books, with the Bramblecay melomys, a small rodent that lives on a tiny island in the eastern Torres Strait, being completely wiped out from its only known location. It is also the first recorded extinction of a mammal anywhere in the world, thought to be primarily due to human-caused climate change. An expert says this extinction is likely just the tip of the iceberg, with climate change exerting increasing pressures on species everywhere. The rodent, also called the mosaic-tailed rat, was only known to live on Bramble Cay, a small coral cay just 340 meters long and 150 meters wide, off the north coast of Queensland, Australia, which sits at most 3 meters above sea level. It had the most isolated and restricted range of any Australian mammal and was considered the only mammal species endemic to the Great Barrier Reef. Omaha.com reports, the nuclear plant at Fort Calhoun is simply too expensive to run when compared to other cheaper forms of power, the Omaha Public Power District's chief executive said Thursday. So it needs to shut down by the end of the year, he said. OPPD president and chief executive Tim Burke told the utility's board of directors that it no longer makes financial sense to continue operations at Fort Calhoun, which is the smallest nuclear power plant in the United States. The site for the plant was purchased in 1965. Burke said he expects the plant to enter a cold shutdown in October of this year if the board proceeds with the recommendation. In a cold shutdown, pressure and temperature conditions within the plant's nuclear reactor are lowered to a level that prevents a nuclear chain reaction from occurring. From there, the utility would proceed with various regulatory applications required to decommission the plant. That process includes dismantling the facility, decontaminating it, and safely storing or disposing of radioactive materials. Burke said spent fuel rods probably would remain at the site. There is nowhere else to take them because a proposed radioactive waste repository at Yucca Mountain is in South Central Nevada is still in limbo. For now, radioactive waste from nuclear power plants is stored on-site in concrete casks. DemocracyNow.org reports, in Vancouver, Washington, more than 100 people formed a human blockade across railway tracks to protest the transportation of oil by rail. The action came after a Union Pacific oil train derailed in Moser, Oregon, earlier this month, causing a massive fire and prompting evacuations. Earlier in the day, the fire chief addressed the crowd who gathered before the district the direct action. Chief Jim Appleton had previously defended the safety of oil by rail, but he has become an outspoken opponent of the shipments following the fiery derailment in his town. And finally, WAFWA.org reports, the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, or WAFWA, has finalized the purchase of approximately 30,000 acres of high-quality lesser prairie chicken habitat in southwest Kansas. The permanent protection and long-term conservation of lesser prairie chicken habitat is an important goal of the Lesser Prairie Chicken Range-Wide Conservation Plan. Funding for this acquisition comes from the voluntary contributions of industry partners that are enrolled in the range-wide plan. Quote, the acquisition of Sunview Ranch is a significant positive development to conserve the lesser lesser prairie chicken, end quote, said Alexa Sandoval, director of the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish and chairman of the Lesser Prairie Chicken Initiative Council. Quote, this transaction involved a willing seller of land that contains prime lesser prairie chicken habitat and furthers our goal of providing a stronghold of at least 25,000 acres in each of the ecoregions where the lesser prairie chicken is still found. We commend all of our partners for their continued commitment to conservation of the lesser prairie chicken, end quote. The range-wide plan is a collaborative effort of WAFWA and the state wildlife agencies of Kansas, Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. It was developed to ensure conservation of the lesser prairie chicken through voluntary cooperation by landowners and industry. We are going to take a break, and we'll be right back with our special guests.
So how is the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, really doing? Now, hearing some candidates for office, you'd think it's wrecking our economy, premiums are skyrocketing, insurance companies are abandoning the program. What are the facts? Radioactive Magazine interviews Stephanie Moore, HHS Regional Director, Region 7. Tune in for an enlightening discussion of the myths and misconceptions surrounding this six-year-old law, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
The 1979 National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights was an important moment for the LGBTQ communities. Tens of thousands marched on Washington chanting, "We are everywhere." Hear recordings from this historic event on From the Vault, Wednesday morning at 5.
Crop-based biofuels and water resources on this current cast. Burning biofuels releases fewer greenhouse gases than fossil fuels, but producing them uses a lot of water. Corn-based ethanol is what we've historically seen at the pump, but it requires a lot of energy and water to make. Grasses generally need less water to grow since you can plant a varied and more resilient crop. But Kerry King of the University of Texas at Austin says the mixed materials are more challenging to refine, so they have their own drawbacks. Research is now focusing on making biofuel from algae that can grow in wastewater. But King says protecting the environment still means using less fuel of any kind.
Biofuels, like many technologies, are no panacea.
Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us on Eco Radio tonight. We are going to be talking about the Urban Grown Tour, and my guests tonight are Lily Siebert from Cultivate KC, Neil Rudersell, and Lisa Hummel from the Woodland City KC, and Nicole Routh from the Scion Garden. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay. Let me start with, I think this tour was pretty much organized by Cultivate KC, so let me start with Lily.
Sure.
And can you tell us a little bit, first of all, what is Cultivate KC?
Sure. Cultivate Kansas City is a nonprofit organization that focuses on developing urban agriculture here in Kansas City. We run several physical programs and as well as helping other urban farmers in our community provide assistance to them in any way. So we have a couple of physical farms, Gibbs Road Farm and Juniper Gardens Training Farm, that are both growing food for our table.
Why don't we hold off a second?
Okay. We are back after that announcement from the Weather Service. And Lily, if you want to finish, I'm not sure,
sure.
Quite where you left off.
I don't know either. I just hope those thunderstorms stay away for this weekend. That wouldn't be fun for the tour. Well, I was talking about Cultivate Kansas City, which is a local nonprofit that helps develop urban agriculture. And a part of our organization is we organized this Urban Grown Tour, started back in 2005, and was a biannual event for several years. And this is the first year that it's become an annual event. So we host a self-guided tour all across the city, and have 31 tour sites this year that are showcasing the diversity of food projects in our community.
Right. Now, they had 31 last year, so are they the same sites this year?
Different sites, all new sites.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you went last year, it's all new stuff.
All right, let me have you tell us a little bit, because we talked about, you mentioned Juniper Gardens and
Gibbs Road Farm.
Gibbs Road.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about those two?
Please? Absolutely. So Juniper Gardens Training Farm is home of New Roots for Refugees, which is a training program for refugees who have been placed in Kansas City. And they have an agricultural background, but they don't know how to translate those skills that they have from their home country into the United States. So it's a four-year training program, and we give them all of the skills that they need in order to become farm entrepreneurs and run successful farm businesses. So it's like market training and actual physical growing practices, and it's a four-year training program. We've had 17 graduates since the program started, and of those 17 graduates, 9 of them are running their own farms, and it's a four-year program. So it's a pretty extensive, it's like farm college.
And is this something that's supported by grants, or do they have to pay to tuition?
It's much of it is supported by grant funding, absolutely. Okay. It's not a tuition-based thing.
All right.
And it's a partnership with Catholic Charities, so it's a lot of also kind of the social aspects of translating into a new community as well. And then the other program that we were discussing was the Gibbs Road Farm, which Neil might be able to shed a little bit of light on as well, because he was a farm apprentice there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So Gibbs Road Farm is also a training farm, but also a production farm that is a example of how you can make a successful farm business on a very small plot of land. So they have about an acre and a half of production, and off of that acre they grow 25,000 pounds of produce every year. And it's so unlike Juniper, it's not grant assisted, so all of the funds that go back into the program help the project run. So it's showing the community that you really can make a living and be a successful farm business on a small scale.
All right. And what about the Food Forest?
Yeah, so the Food Forest is a really wonderful project that isn't, the idea of it is kind of a self-sustaining idea, so we don't, it's not as high maintenance as some of our other programs, so maybe I forget about talking about it sometimes, but it's a very cool program close to our Gibbs Road Farm that is a permaculture food forest. So the idea is that you plant all of these perennial plants, and then it's kind of a self-sustaining food forest that will grow food for many, many years.
And when you say permaculture, tell
yes.
the audience what that
is. Oh, I'm not a permaculture expert. So if somebody else in this room is, they should speak up. But permaculture is a method of growing food that has a really wonderful connection with the land and helps with soil sustainability and all of those important things that conventional agriculture neglects.
All right. In the Gibbs farm, that includes the greenhouse, community greenhouse?
The community greenhouse, absolutely, yes.
And how many farmers participate in that then?
Do you know?
Oh, something like 8 or 10, I suppose, different farmers that rent greenhouse space that don't have access to a greenhouse. And then they utilize some of our amendments and soil inputs. And then obviously it's an opportunity for us to you know, talk to other growers about their techniques, different crops that they're growing, and just basically learn from each other.
All right. And since you were an apprentice there, tell us a little bit more you can add to that.
Yeah, you know, the apprentice program is an opportunity for someone to come and learn about growing on a small scale with really relatively no experience. When I went there, I had some rudimentary experience with growing vegetables, but never in a production system. We use bio-intensive cropping, a lot of succession cropping. We use very little mechanization. It's mostly all done with our own hands, and we grow year-round. So you have an opportunity, and we're fortunate enough to live in a part of the country where it's you can grow year-round if you use proper technique. So we're out there in the winter harvesting when it's snowy and icy and cold out, as long as we get enough sun. We're out there inside of hoop houses or high tunnels, which are essentially non-heated greenhouses, growing vegetables that are cool-tolerant crops year-round. So it might be really cold, and we're complaining about the temperatures outside. However, we're inside of hoop houses and short-sleeve shirts, harvesting spinach and kales and whatnot. So the idea is to an idea would be to get a jump on the season using some of those techniques, right? So you can get your tomatoes in when it's still March or something like that. So those are some of the just basic techniques that they teach out there, along with how to penetrate and access different markets. So how does a young farmer who's never grown anything before learn about pricing, right? Or figuring out different margins that you want to make on crops? Not just that, but we try to promote other sustainability practices, like using less water. And obviously, it's all organic, so we're using good seed and good inputs, and managing the soil, the health of the soil, which is obviously important. So those are some of the basic things that you learn during the apprentice program. And then you'd also get the freedom to add your own expertise. So we have someone on staff there that is, I wouldn't say an expert in permaculture, but he has knowledge in it. So we talk about permaculture using, like a hugel culture, and figuring out different ways to set up beds to, funnel water, that kind of stuff. But you could bring something to the table, right? So the idea is they teach you these techniques, but there's a freedom there for you to come with an idea and try to baby that and learn about it, and then we all learn about it.
And you mentioned that it's all organic.
Correct. Yes, okay. It's certified organic, correct.
And for those who are not familiar with what's required for that, mm-hmm. what steps do you have to follow to get it certified as organic?
And let me be clear, I'm no expert, and I have to probably assume that most people that are certified organic aren't experts either, because rules change all the time, right? But the idea is that certain inputs you can and can't use, certain practices you can and can't use. The seed that you use has to be certified organic. So we don't use pesticides, herbicides, or fungicides to grow our crops. Now, of course, there are different herbicides and pesticides and those things that are considered organic. We don't use them there. The only thing we would do to get rid of, say, squash bugs is to go out there and pick them off of the plant, or to cover the crop with a row cover before it starts flowering or something. So the process to become certified organic is, I believe, yearly. The USDA comes out and looks at your facility, makes sure that you're practicing good practices, looking at your seed records to make sure that you're only using organic seed, and those sorts of things. I mean, it can get really nitpicky at times, but the manager there takes care of that sort of thing. It's not something that the apprentices do, because it's a pretty major task in itself to become certified organic. There's costs involved, all that sort of thing.
And I know one of the objects of this is to encourage people to buy locally produced mm-hmm. produce. So do you, how do you promote the local produce? Let me ask you that.
Yeah, so basically Cultivate has a couple different revenue streams, I guess maybe is your question. So how do we put our product out in the community? We do it at a farmer's market on Saturdays. We have a CSA, which, if the listeners aren't familiar with that, it's community support agriculture. The idea is you kind of buy a share into the farm early on in the season as a way of giving a farmer, in this case Gibbs Road, access to capital to buy seed, to pay for labor, as it takes several months of preparation with no income to get the farm going before you can start selling at market. Now, of course, I mentioned that we go year-round, so we do have some revenue coming in the winter, but it's minimal compared to what you need to start the production. So CSA, farmers market, and then direct restaurant sales.
So when you're promoting it as local, how far out would the typical local farm go with their marketing? How many miles?
I think that's really up to the consumer or the distributor and what they want to label as local. We produce this food at Gibbs Road Farm on basically 635 and I-35 at that interchange there, and we sell to restaurants that are all in Kansas City, and the farmers market is in Kansas City. So we're only a few miles from all of our distribution points. But I wouldn't argue with someone if they call themselves local and sold, in Lawrence. I mean, I think compared to what the food system has gotten, the amount of miles food travels now, I that's considered local to me.
So, and unlike organic, local isn't a regulated thing by the government. So there isn't a standard that you can be considered organic, or I'm sorry, local, that the government will come in and put a sticker on your produce and say that is certified local. But certified organic, you do have to follow those regulations and standards.
Right. And I know some crops, or at least fruits, or a lot of them are imported mm-hmm. from South America, pineapples, mm-hmm. bananas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If somebody wants local, are those things, the items, can they be grown here?
I mean, again, anything's possible, right? If you want to grow in potentially a greenhouse and control the humidity and the temperature and spend a lot of inputs to doing that, but it's just not sustainable, to use the buzzword, I would suggest that people that to try new fruits and vegetables that are grown in your region. And you might be surprised that you prefer peaches and apples to bananas and pineapples, and then enjoy those products when you're in Latin America.
And what are some of the fruits that you focused a lot on the vegetables? What are some of the fruits that are being grown by the farms affiliated?
Well, and that gets tricky now. Organic fruit production, and I am no expert in this, by the way, is tricky. They're very susceptible to diseases, to pests, so it's tough. There are a few farms that are trying to do more fruit production, but this is a common suggestion that people make at the farmers market to have more fruit. But it's just very difficult. They're just not as disease resistant as, say, a tomato or something like that. So, to my knowledge, there's not a big organic vegetable production system happening here in Kansas City. Now, that's not to say there's not a lot of people doing it. There are, but it's definitely still figuring out ways. Brooke Salvaggio and her partner Dan, they are doing a lot of organic fruit production. So, if anybody's interested in that, I would suggest looking them up, and they might have more insight as to the organic fruit movement happening here.
And are they one of the farms on the
They're field? Not on this year.
Sorry,
they have been in the past.
Proper plug.
But the food forest does have a lot of fruit production. We have raspberries also, and blackberries. The brambles are and Gibbs has peaches.
Yeah,
so
we have some.
There is fruit production happening at most of our sites, just not on the large scale.
I was just saying to be consistent at a market weekly. Like, we're going to have tomatoes coming up in July, and we'll have them until it freezes, right, consecutively. But like with cherries, you get a harvest. We might have some at the food forest, but mostly we ate them while we were harvesting them. They're not enough to go sell to your restaurants and make cherry pies and people enjoy them, for a month,
All right. And moving from, we talked about Gibbs Farm, tell us about the Woodland City KC that
Yeah, so Woodland City KC was a project that me and my partner Lisa started 3 years ago. Again, using some of the techniques that we learned at Cultivate, we chose the area of Kansas City in the neighborhood of Ivanhoe when we were looking for a house to buy for basically nothing, and we wanted to buy some land for basically nothing, and it took us into that area of Kansas City. Looking at different neighborhoods, we found the Ivanhoe neighborhood to be very organized. And with their organization, they have different committees. And one of their committees is based on food production called Grown in Ivanhoe. So having that foundation already being built into that neighborhood, Grown in Ivanhoe has a farmer's market. They have monthly classes on gardening. They're expanding and building more community gardens and market gardens over this next year. So we chose that community to move into, to buy our house, to renovate it, and then turn essentially a 8,000 square foot, what used to be, quote, vacant lot, into a highly productive food system. We bought three lots. We're only producing on one of them, but we have two more that we are going to start turning into a production system over the next year.
Mm-hmm. All right. And as far as the restaurants, you mentioned that you sell a lot of this. And is that true with the Sion Garden? Is that a lot of your stuff being sold to restaurants?
The Sion Garden?
Yeah.
No. Sure. The Sion Garden is a schoolyard garden at Sion Lower School at 39th and Locust. And we have students Montessori through eighth grade participating directly in the food production for their school lunch program and to take home or to enjoy as classroom snacks.
All right. Is there a website that they can go to for Woodland City to see what restaurants
Yeah, and use that. Yeah, we're at Woodland City KC is our Instagram, and then we're on Facebook as well. But let me back up and be clear about something too. Woodland City went into a food insecure neighborhood to grow food for the neighborhood. While we develop the garden, it costs money to develop, and while we're renovating the house, we're using the profits that we brought in from the garden to do that. That's the primary focus. The secondary focus is to be able to distribute the food to neighbors or at the Ivanhoe Farmers Market or those that actually need it at a more equitable price for those in that neighborhood. So right now we do sell to restaurants, but we do want to move into more distribution to neighbors and people in the neighborhood. It just it takes a lot of money to actually that's not true. It didn't take a lot of money, but to get the whole system going. We're using our profits from restaurants to do that, but eventually want to move into distribution to people in our neighborhood.
And can you tell us a little bit more about Scion Garden?
Absolutely. Okay. The Scion Garden is it's one of the largest schoolyard gardens in the Kansas City area, and we're part of the Schoolyard Gardens program through Kansas City Community Gardens. And we have 24 4x12 raised beds, 20 fruit trees, and 8 beds devoted to herbs and flowers. And like I said, the students participate in all stages of food production from seed to harvest, and much of the food is used in our school lunch program.
All right. And are there other schools that are involved in similar programs? I think I've heard of similar concepts.
Yes, the Schoolyard Gardens program has over 200 schools in the metro area that participate. It's quite an impressive program, and so lots and lots of schools are doing this to varying degrees. Some schools might just have a couple of beds, and some schools might have a dozen or more beds. It just sort of depends on what the school decides to do.
And you mentioned that that food, a lot of it's being used for the school lunch.
Yes.
Lunches. When there's leftover foods, is some of that sent home to some of the kids that are from some of the families that are food insecure? Or?
Well, we don't really have a population of students who have food insecurity at our school. And we also don't really have a lot of extra food. The way that we plan our crops is it's sort of a recursive process of figuring out what the kids like to eat, what our school chef likes to prepare, and what ingredients will work best. And so the planning of the menu and the planning of the garden all happen together. So food menu items are chosen with the amount of food available items in mind. Like, for example, we have a big sweet potato dig each October, and we provide enough sweet potatoes for usually 2 rounds of school lunch for the entire school. When we have had excess, we have the high school also, and she's been able to use some items in the high school lunch program. And she's very, very good about she's very creative about integrating items into the menu.
All right. We do need to take our next break in just a minute. And when we come back, we will take phone calls. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us at 816-931-5534.
Naomi Klein.
So the appetite for this kind of transformative project is enormous. And we see all of this as more signs that although establishment politicians fear change, a great many people are hungry for it. We understand that we've gone so far off course and time is so short that we now have to go for it on all fronts. At this late hour, with so much to lose and with so much to gain, now is not the time for small steps. Now is the time for boldness. Now is the time to leap. Thank you.
Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
Do you have a car, truck, or boat you no longer need? Please donate it to KKFI. Please call Bill at 816-994-7869.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Electric vehicle batteries can do more than power cars. In Lünen, Germany, thousands of old EV batteries are getting a new life as part of an energy storage facility. These batteries will support renewable energy because they can supply power even when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. The project is a collaboration between automotive giant Daimler and two other companies. It will store 13 megawatt hours of power, enough to run a small city. It may sound strange to build a new power station that relies on old batteries, but it actually makes a lot of sense. Harold Kroger, Daimler's head of electrics for Mercedes-Benz cars, explains that even when an EV battery is too worn out to run a car, it can still be put to good use.
The battery might not be in perfect shape anymore to drive a car, but it's perfectly apted to storing energy in a stationary way.
Since batteries lose their potential to charge over time, Kroger says there will be an abundant supply of used batteries when the EVs sold today turn 10 years old. Giving old batteries a second life might also make electric vehicles a little less expensive for consumers someday. And that could help drive the world towards a more sustainable transportation system. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, we're back with guests for Cultivate KC and a couple farms that are participating in the Urban Grown Tour this year. And we do have a caller on the line. Caller, if you'll state your first name and what part of town you're calling from.
Hi, I'm from Independence, and my name's John.
Okay, and what question or comment do you have?
I actually had a question about how does someone with a full-time job get started with the whole organic farming and permaculture and then producing enough to feed more than his family?
Yeah, so I guess I'll feel that question because you've kind of described me. So I'm the health initiatives manager at the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council, and on top of that, we do Woodland City KC. It's difficult. I don't know if I have a blueprint for it. On harvest days, my partner and I wake up, at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and we harvest until it's time to get ready to go to work. And then we'll come home that day, take the food out of the cooler and clean it and then distribute it. So we kind of just work in off hours. I would suggest finding a couple people to partner with so then it could relax some of the burden that it takes. But to us, setting up the garden was the hardest part. Manicuring it and giving it maintenance is a lot less time consuming. So you might have to, organize yourself to spend a lot of time getting it set up. Like, for example, we don't till our beds. The beds are there. They don't move. They stay the same place. The pathways don't move. They stay the same place. The irrigation system's in place. It never changes. So you're just kind of maintaining it. So the biggest amount of time input is the starting of it. So those are some suggestions I guess I would have.
I would suggest going on the Urban Grown Tour. It's a great way to get other examples and information from people who are doing the same things that you're interested in.
All right. Thank you for that question, caller. And if anybody else has any questions, you can call us at 816-931-5534. Lily, let me have you just go through again the dates of the tour.
Sure.
And the times.
Yeah, those are important details.
And how do they, I assume they go to your website, so what to find out what more farms are involved.
Yeah, so if you go to our website, which is cultivatekc.org, you can see all of the 31 sites that are on the tour and read a short description and see some pictures of them. Also, if you go on to our social media, we've been doing something every Friday called Farm Story Friday, where you can read a little bit about each farm that way as well. We aren't doing every farm there, but some of them. So the tour dates are this weekend, June 25th and 26th, and from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday the 25th, and then from noon to 5 p.m. on Sunday. And you just get a ticket online, and then you go to your first tour site during the tour, and you get a wristband, and then that wristband is your ticket to the whole weekend. So you can go and visit any site that you like, anything that calls to you. You can design your own farm tour that speaks specifically to your desires.
And I understand there's a kickoff event on Wednesday?
On Wednesday, June 22nd, just in a couple days. Oh.
Okay, we are back. I hope you are all staying safe. Of course, we do need the rain for the farmers, and that's who we're talking to tonight, so maybe it's not that bad of a deal. You would talk about, let me have you tell a little bit more about that kickoff event.
Sure, yeah. We have a kickoff for the Urban Grown Tour, which is called Bringing People to the Table, on June 22nd at Tomsdown Distilling in the Crossroads. And it's a celebration of all of our Kansas City food traditions. I should clarify, not all of our Kansas City food traditions, because there's a lot, but at least some of them. We're going to have a range of different cultural representations, from fresh tamales to a traditional corn Choctaw dish. And we'll also have a signature cocktail from Tomstown, which is called the Pinky Blitz, very fun name, and Amigoni wine and Boulevard beer.
And where is this Tomstown Distilling located?
It's at 1701 Main, which is in the Crossroads. It's a pretty fun distilling. So they're a local producer. They create their own vodka, gin, and whiskey at the space.
All right. And again, if anybody has any questions, you can call in at 816-931-5534. And we would talk about a little bit about fruits before. I have to ask a question if anybody knows. One of my favorite fruits that I've acquired a taste for is gooseberries.
Oh yeah.
I've been buying gooseberry pies and stuff. And when I went to Colorado, there was a gooseberry place there, and she said that she has them shipped in from somewhere in Kansas City because they don't grow very well in Colorado.
They grow beautifully here. They're a really wonderful berry to grow here.
So what I've always wondered, and there's a few other berries like mulberries that I like.
Yeah.
If they grow here, why don't the grocery stores carry those?
Some do, in fact.
Oh.
I know that the Sundry, also in the Crossroads, they used a lot of mulberries. Heirloom Bakery in Brookside, they bought a lot of mulberries, and I know a lot of places use gooseberries and make pies. So we do have a little bit of it. Of course, it would be great to see a wider market, for sure, and getting it into bigger areas.
And at Cultivate, the mulberries only get consumed by those of us that work there. We take breaks underneath the mulberry tree and enjoy the shade and eat all the berries, so none of those make it to market.
Oh.
you can blame the assistant farm manager for that.
Okay. One of the things that we just had a guest on last week that was talking about the food insecurity. And she mentioned that, I think it was, if we just cut out 25% of the waste nationwide, we would be able to feed, I think she said, 85 million people with just cutting it by 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're in this type of farming and you're focusing on local farming, are there things that you're involved in to help assure that it's marketed in the way that it's not wasted, or things that, you know, that traditional farms may throw away that you find markets for?
Well, that is the beauty of small-scale agriculture. You know, the issue of food insecurity in our country and in our world is really more focused on distribution and not on production. We know it to be a fact that we produce plenty of food to feed our world, and yet there are still people who are going hungry. So small-scale agriculture, they don't have the luxury of wasting food. Everything that they produce, they have to sell and or consume in order to make a living and survive. So when you have an intimate environment like that with your food, you can and have a closer relationship to it and make sure that the products are all being used.
And one thing I've found as a schoolyard garden coordinator is that when kids participate in the food production, when they grow their own food, they're much less likely to throw it away or to toss things aside from the lunch tray. And so I feel like getting kids involved in that and helping kids to understand what it actually takes to grow food is one way to address the issue of food waste.
So we have two methods of distributing what I guess we're referring to as, we shouldn't call it waste, when we overproduce or when we don't distribute to restaurants all the crops that we harvest. Our neighbors get a nice little bag full of things that we have, and then our chickens are the other beneficiaries of our overproduction. So nothing goes to waste at our farm either.
And do you take a lot of your food to the local farmer markets?
Yeah, I personally don't yet. Ivanhoe, as I mentioned, does have a farmer's market. I haven't sold at it yet. It's sort of, we try to showcase the growers there in Ivanhoe that have kind of developed the market. So, I don't take mine to market yet.
Okay. And I'm not sure if you mm-hmm. said before, but where is Ivanhoe at?
Yeah, so Ivanhoe is a wonderful neighborhood that's located between Paseo and Prospect, going east to west to east, and then 31st Street down to Cleaver. So it's in Kansas City's east side, and they're very sympathetic to those that want to come and grow. It's has some of the most vacant parcels of land in Kansas City, so there's plenty of opportunity to come down there to get some of these pieces of vacant land and to produce vegetables on them. We also have 40% housing vacancy. So you could potentially come into the neighborhood and buy a house and a half acre of land next to your house for, you know, the amount of money someone makes in a day. And that's not really even a joke. And you can, again, start a farm and build a house here in the inner urban core for much less than what you would spend on any acreage outside of the city. So it's another advantage to small-scale urban agriculture, where the young farmer doesn't have to go into such enormous debt to start their farm. You could literally start your farm for hundreds, if not a couple thousand dollars, and be producing, you know, relatively quickly.
One of the shows that we did in the past, Delaney Ellis, I think was her name. She runs an organization where they're training veterans to get into farming and local farming. And there were a fair number from this area, including some from Leavenworth. Are any of those farms in this tour?
No, we don't. You know, there's a wonderful thing about our area is that there are so many food and farm projects. and so, unfortunately, we can't have them all on the tour. But as it's an annual event for the first time this year, we'll be able to continually rotate through more farm sites. So there's no veteran projects on the tour this year, but maybe next year.
Okay. And so you try to change the farms each year then?
We try to give enough variety. Our farms that are Cultivate Kansas City Farms, that are our sites, they are kind of the hub of the tour, so those don't rotate through. But we do try and get enough tour sites on there that are different every year so that people who can go on the tour every year have something new to see.
All right. And in terms of working with the students and stuff, do they follow them through? Like if they start, I don't know how young they start typically, but if they're in grade school, is there a program they can participate in to follow them through, like through high school, if that's a career that they decide they want to go into?
We don't have a farming career program in place per se, but the kids start in Montessori, and each classroom is responsible for a different bed. So we're getting ready to start a garden at the high school. Mostly they just learn, they learn how to take care of the bed and how to, you know, they choose what to grow, and they participate in caring for it and how to deal with the curveballs that come your way, you know, with gardening. We do everything organically, just like at Gibbs Road Farm.
There are some opportunities to, Johnson County has the Sustainable Ag Program there, which I actually am a graduate of, and then lots of apprenticeship opportunities. So Cultivate KC, and I know other farms have apprentices. And then again, Ivanhoe has a Grown in Ivanhoe, which are classes given to teach people how to grow their own food or how to market their own food. So there's maybe more grassroots educational opportunities as opposed to maybe some structural. But however, Johnson County does have a program, and it's pretty successful.
Okay, we are just about out of time. We've got about 1 minute left, so if you can give a quick answer to the other question I have, is GMOs. Are all these farms free of GMOs?
Oh, what an answer. What a quick answer to give.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, if you're organic, then you don't use GMO seed.
Okay, so that would not allow that. Okay, yep. All right. So if you just joined us, you've been listening to us talking about the 2016 Urban Grown Tour, and my guests have been Lily Siebert from Cultivate KC, Neil Rudisill from Woodland City KC, and Nicole Routh, a member of the Sion Garden. So thank you for joining us, and if anybody missed part of that, the show, we do podcasts this, so listen to the podcast later. And next, some messages in the calendar.
On the next forum.
The average young person wants to have a purpose. They want to have meaning. ISIS provides a contrasting alternative. Fight for God or live in materialistic hedonism.
Confronting extremist violence, the refugee crisis, and fear. Faith responses. Wednesday evening at 6.
What does my faith say about this?
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
The fact is that we have reached a point which is really a crisis or an emergency.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week our guests include NASA's chief climatologist, Dr. James Hansen. It's the Clean Energy Climate Challenge on The Bioneers.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics.
And now the calendar of events. June 22nd through 25th, all day, the Urban Food System Symposium at Kansas State University's Olathe campus. The symposium brings together researchers, not-for-profit administrators, community organizers, extension professionals, students, and others to share and gain knowledge on urban food systems and agriculture and their role in global food security. Focuses on food production and distribution in cities, urban planning and development, nutrition and human health, food policy and education. And more information about that at urbanfoodsystemssymposium.org. And again, that's Wednesday through Saturday. And also on June 25th from 10 to 3, Honey Beekeeping 201, how to install bees, use a bee smoker, maintain the hive at Powell Gardens Beekeeping 201 class. Includes hive inspection and how to identify and treat common diseases. The ins and outs of fall honey harvest and honey extraction using actual frames, if the honey is available then. There will also be emphasis on beekeeping safety. And the event will be held 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Powell Gardens. And more information at Powell Gardens' website. Powell Gardens is at Kingsville, Missouri. And the Urban Grown Tour is coming up this weekend. You may have heard if you've been listening to the program, June 25th and 26th. Explore the inspirational food and farm projects around our city. The tour will kick off with a Kansas City food celebration on Wednesday, June 22nd at Tomstown Distilling. More information at cultivatekc.org. And that about does it. Naomi Klein is on Alternative Radio Wednesday, not to be missed, speaking about the next radical leap, and of course, Bioneers, as you just heard about on Friday morning. My name is Mike Murphy, and we'll have Elaine Giesel back here next week talking about the Prairie Dogs right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM. We're going to go out with This Week in Water, and then stay tuned for Fiesta Musical.
When I go to buy household products like toys or carpets, I expect that someone somewhere, probably in government, made sure they were safe and free of toxins. But the truth is, it's a little closer to how Donald Rumsfeld put it in a news briefing about weapons of mass destruction.
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
When it comes to chemicals, it's sort of the same thing. There's a lot of known unknowns. We know that there are over 84,000 industrial chemicals used commercially in the United States. Not known, the full extent of their health impacts. Only 9 dangerous chemicals have been studied enough to be banned or restricted by the EPA. The rest of them, they're in daily use, in personal care products, in pharmaceuticals, household items, and of course, in industrial applications. And because there was no requirement to prove their safety before putting them on the market, potentially toxic chemicals are getting into our air and water. Some compounds have scientists sounding alarm bells. They're called PFCs, and they're used to make water and stain-resistant clothes and nonstick cookware. You might know these chemicals by their brand names like Teflon, Scotchgard, and Stainmaster. PFOA is one PFC that was put into use before health impacts came to light. In 2006, major manufacturers agreed to phase it out, but it's extremely persistent, meaning it will take eons to break down, so generations to come are going to be dealing with the consequences. What kind of consequences? Ask the residents of the Ohio River Valley.
DuPont used PFOA to help polymerize Teflon and released PFOA into the river and the air during a large number of years from the kind of early 1950s through the early 2000s.
That's Professor Kyle Steenland.
And I'm a professor in environmental health at Emory University.
The PFOA from the DuPont factory spilled into the Ohio River.
And the water of the Ohio River, it entered the groundwater, which was used for public drinking water, in the surrounding area.
The DuPont Corporation is facing more than 3,000 lawsuits from residents who allege that the contamination made them sick. In one large class action in 2005, they reached a settlement agreement that included creating a science panel, of which Professor Steenland was a member, to assess whether or not there was a probable link between C8 exposure and human disease.
Again, our best judgment was that 6 diseases are associated with PFOA exposure.
Diseases like?
Kidney cancer, testicular cancer, thyroid disease, ulcerative colitis, pregnancy-induced hypertension.
So are we less at risk from PFCs if we don't live near a chemical or plastics plant? Perhaps not. Research from Stockholm University has shown that the chemicals are so ubiquitous in air and water, they're taken up by crops and are in our food supply. And because PFCs are in so many household products, from your waterproof jacket to your furniture, the CDC says pretty much anyone who breathes air and drinks water has minute quantities in their bloodstream. Given that the chemicals are nearly impossible to avoid and are building up every day in the environment, do scientists think this is urgent?
So I think it's almost the wrong question.
That's Debbie Raffel, the director of San Francisco's Department of the Environment.
Because I don't think any of us can answer that question, even the proponents. Nobody can really tell the world whether or not this is urgent or if it will become urgent. And so instead, the question I think is the right question for us to ask, because it's a question that we can actually answer today, is it necessary? Is it necessary to continue to be using these kinds of chemicals in commerce? Yes, they're legal. Are they safe?
She says the only way to answer that question is more study. Lots of study, which invariably leads to paralysis by analysis.
And you then can argue the science about how much is safe and how big is the problem and is it urgent, is it not urgent?
Instead, she thinks we should be asking whether there's a safer alternative, but...
Sometimes what happens with industry is they point to an alternative that appears to be better, but part of the reason that it appears to be better is there's less study on it, more unknown.
That raises the issue of how we regulate chemicals in the first place. In the U.S., unlike Europe, we put them out there first and ask questions later.
It didn't used to be that way. United States was amazing. In the 1970s, we passed the Toxic Substances Control Act, affectionately known as TSCA, and it was radical for its time. It came into being very close to the time that the EPA came into being, that the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. There was a time in the 70s where the U.S. was very much at the cutting edge of protecting human health and the environment.
But we've stagnated since then. It wasn't until this year that Congress finally amended TSCA, but in the 40 years that the act was in place, it didn't accomplish much, so Europe moved way ahead of us.
And so they have their chemicals regulation process called REACH. Regulation, evaluation, authorization of chemicals. And REACH has become the gold standard for how chemicals are regulated in the world.
Europe is looking to regulate PFCs as a class, but the American way is one by one, with each taking years of study. There are about 3,000 PFCs, so you can do the math. We could be waiting a very long time to learn the truth about these chemicals.
It's hard for consumers to know what's in their products. I believe government has an obligation to make sure that even if you're not aware, you're not exposed.
But we as consumers, we can make choices about what we buy, provided we get good information, of course.
What's great about the American system is that the marketplace responds a lot faster than the legislative process. And so if consumers say, no, it's not necessary, no, it's not worth it, that will get companies to reformulate much faster than any amendments we could make to the Toxic Substances Control Act.
No doubt, chemicals are a part of modern life, and we all benefit. No one is saying to get rid of PFCs altogether, but only use the ones that are absolutely essential and come clean about their impacts. That way, we can all agree with DuPont, who famously sang their praises.
Better things for better living through chemistry for the finer world we want.
To go in-depth about PFCs and chemical regulation, visit our website at h2oradio.org, where you'll find links and more information. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halpern.
Better things for better living are coming still. That's the promise of DuPont.
Thanks for listening. Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.